My castaway this week is a writer and publisher. He's the child of one of 20th century England's most unconventional marriages. His parents loved each other deeply, but they enjoyed homosexual affairs. Their son, brought up in beautiful isolation at Sissinghurst Castle in Kent, went to Eton and Oxford, co-founded a famous publishing house, became a Tory MP, and then settled back to writing his books, the most famous of which, Portrait of a Marriage, is all about his extraordinary parents. He is Nigel Nicholson. Those parents were, of course, Harold Nicholson and Vita Sackville-West, who would probably today be mainly remembered for creating the gardens of Sissinghurst if you hadn't written that book about them, Portrait of a Marriage, instead of which perhaps we think first of their homosexual affairs. Do you therefore regret doing that, regret writing that book?
No, it was a great problem whether to publish my mother's autobiography or not, which she wrote when she was only late 20s, about this dramatic affair when she eloped with another woman called Vali Tufusis. And I showed her manuscript, which I found after her death, to one or two of her friends and my brother. And the general opinion was, not unanimous, that this was something which was so excellent as a bit of an autobiography, so interesting, so vivid, that it should be published.
Nevertheless, it took you, what, we waited 10 years before you published it?
Yes, I had to wait, obviously, until after my father had died and Violet and Trefusius had died. And it was during that time, there was 10 years, that I could ponder the rightness or the wrongness of exposing my mother to what some people call matricide. I don't think so at all. I think it actually enhanced her reputation.
Many critics did, though, of course, think that it was quite wrong. Bernard Levin, I think, said that you should have burnt it the minute you found it, the manuscript, and other people called it treachery. How can you be sure that your parents would have wanted their story told?
I think my mother wanted it told.
But what about your
father?
But
I have more doubts about my father. Because in a sort of way, he was the more reticent about that sort of subject than she was. She was all for telling, well, what was really the most dramatic incident in our whole life. But to him, it was a very painful memory. And when I did decide finally to publish the book, it was of him that I was thinking more than of her.
What about of you? I mean, you would have been in your mid-40s when you found this manuscript in the bottom of a Gladstone bag. After
yes,
your
I think
death.
Even older, yeah.
You obviously had it had become gossip about your mother's grande affair with Violet Trefusis in her 20s. But nevertheless, to discover in middle age, from her own hand, the deep passion that she had felt for another woman, how did it affect you?
Well, as you say, I had known vaguely about the story. She'd never mentioned it. My father had never mentioned it. We never discussed sex in our family. It was that sort of family. And so it didn't come as a great shock to me. I was fascinated by her account of it, every detail, supported, of course, by the letters which she had kept, the diaries which she had kept.
More of that later, but let's turn to you and music. What's the first record that you'd play on your desert island?
All my records, really, are very light music, because we weren't a musical family. But all the same, I have loved music all my life. And the sort of tunes that I enjoyed most were Audrey Hepburn in I Could Have Danced All Night from My Fair Lady.
I could have danced all night.
Audrey Hepburn and I Could Have Danced All Night. Let's talk about Sissinghurst, where you still live, although it's owned now by the National Trust, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Can you remember the first time you saw it?
Very well indeed. It was in April 1930. A horrible day. It was pouring with rain. And I went there with my mother. And the place was really virtually derelict. It was just an accumulation of rubbish of several centuries, old tin cans and bottles and wire netting and that sort of thing. There was no electricity, no water, there was no glass in the windows, and many of the doorways had no doors. It was awful. And we walked round in the rain with my mother, and suddenly she turned to me and said, "I think we shall be very happy here." And I said, "But we haven't got to live here, have we?" Thinking of our nice, comfortable little house about 20 miles away. And she said, "Yes, I think we could make something rather beautiful out of it."
So work began, and you and your brother lived separately from your parents in a separate cottage, didn't you? And
yes.
Each of you, each member of the family, had his or her own sitting room. That's
right.
Very unusual.
It was a sort of family university, really. I mean, it sounds very priggish, but we did work awfully hard. My brother and I always won the holiday task prize because we'd read the allotted book 6 times over. Nobody else had read it once.
And your mother's sitting room was up in a tower.
That's right.
And you weren't allowed up there.
I went there, I think, twice in 32 years. It was her sanctum. And although there was no written or even spoken rule about it, we knew that she didn't want to be disturbed there.
So it must have been a very strange experience for you when she died in 1962 to go up into that sitting room.
It was very odd indeed. I'd been twice, as I said, but I didn't really understand what she did there. All her books were still there, her manuscript, the letters which she'd received the day before she died. It was so intimate and strange.
You tried to then occupy it, didn't you? You tried to...
Only for a couple of days. I thought I would take her place at her desk and do my work there. It became totally impossible. It was impregnated with her personality. And so we've left it, and the National Trust have agreed, exactly as it was on the day she died.
Record number 2.
Well, my second record is Paul Robeson singing one of the songs from Saunders of the River, which was a movie he made. And I saw, or heard rather, this song first when I was in Athens, when I was an undergraduate at Oxford. I was very much moved by it. And also I associated it with my love of Greece.
Paul Robeson singing the canoe song from Saunders of the River. Your mother also had a brief affair with Virginia Woolf, but a long friendship when you were a small boy. What are your memories of Virginia Woolf?
I adored her. She was like a favourite aunt. And whenever my mother said, "Virginia's coming to lunch or coming to stay," I was delighted. Because I knew that there would come a moment when she would say, "Vita, go away. Can't you see I'm talking to Ben and Nigel? Ben's my brother." And then she would ask us about our simple lives, our school lives. She'd say, "What's the French mistress like?" And we would say, as children do, "Oh, she's all right." "No, no, 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 that won't do. What sort of shoes does she wear?" She was really teaching us to observe.
So she was very inventive and great fun, but with children. But did you ever see her more challenging side with grown-ups? Did you ever see her get angry, or did you ever see that madness?
I never saw madness. I saw the challenging side of her, and it could be rather formidable. I remember once my mother took me to a Bloomsbury party. I was about 12 years old then. And Virginia told one of her funniest stories. She could be very funny. And then when the laughter had died down, she turned to one of the youngest people in the room, apart from myself. It was a girl of about 18 or 19. And she said, "Now you tell us a story." Of course, and all these Bloomsbury characters, these formidable creatures like Lytton Strachey and T.S. Eliot, you know, turn to this poor girl who burst into tears.
Mm. Your mother didn't like it. Your mother called it the Gloomsbury set.
Yes, she didn't really fit in, and they didn't really accept her because she was Virginia's friend, you know, and apart from Clive Bell, she didn't really know the others. She hated Lytton Strachey, for example, who could be very unkind.
So and what did Virginia then see in your mother if the others didn't like her?
She saw in her beauty. I mean, there was undoubtedly a physical attraction between the two women. And she saw in her aristocracy. Virginia was a bit of a snob. And Vita came from the Sackville families, from Knowles. She had all that in her background. And also a certain motherliness towards Virginia. She cared for her, cosseted her, one might almost say.
But your father was terrified, obviously mixed emotions, when it was discovered that your mother was having an affair with Virginia, wasn't he? He said it was like lighting a flame over an open petrol tank.
My father, who was a very understanding man, said, this is marvellous. She will do all the good in the world. But for heaven's sake, be careful. You might trigger off a new attack of her insanity.
Record number three.
Record number three is my only, so to speak, classical record, which is the famous Bolero Ravel, which I like for its mounting exhilaration.
Part of Ravel's Bolero, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So, Nigel Nicholson, you went up to Eton and then to Balliol and then into the Grenadier Guards, aged 22, and war broke out about a year later. Did you have a good war?
I had, I suppose, the best sort of war, if war can ever be described as good. Best in the sense that I was in a regiment where I felt at home, the Grenadiers. I was never wounded, and yet I saw action, both from the front line a little bit in Tunisia, and also when we moved on to Italy. And I remember once writing to my father, there's nothing more enjoyable, you know, than liberating or conquering a country. And he wrote back and said, Hitler feels exactly the same way, reminding me that what I was engaged in might be very dramatic and romantic when one actually occupied lovely towns and was greeted by all these lovely Italian girls with roses and wine. But all the same, it was a wicked thing to happen.
And then at the end of the war, you were involved in the forcible repatriation of some anti-Tito Yugoslavs from Austria back into communist hands. That you described as horrible.
I think it was the worst incident in all my war career. I had to put these men and women and some children to whom we had given asylum in southern Austria, people who were flying from Tito. They were Yugoslavs, but they were anti-Tito. And we had to send them back to Tito by an arrangement made by some superior headquarters. And as they would have refused to go mount the trains if they'd known where they were going, we had to lie to them. We had to tell them that they were going to Italy, when I'm afraid we were sending them over the frontier to almost certain death.
You were obeying orders, obviously, and as a young captain that was your job, but do you retain an awful guilt about it?
I do, but less so than if I'd made no protest at the time. And in retrospect, nothing pleases me more than I did protest in writing at the time.
More music.
Well, the next one is also connected with the war, and it's the famous tune Lily Marlene. This, of course, was the war song of the Rommel's Africa Corps. And when, at the end of the North African campaign in Tunisia, we surrounded the Africa Corps and they surrendered, they marched off into captivity in long lines. I was there with them, with a handful of British soldiers, just to keep guard. And as they marched, slowly they began to sing this haunting song, which had also become our song. And our soldiers joined in English, while the Germans sang in German.
Lily Marlene, sung by the 11th Army Officers Training School of Hamburg. Back home then to London, and you bumped into a chap called Weidenfeld, and you decided to set up a publishing company. Was it as simple as that?
It wasn't quite as simple as that, because Weidenfeld at that time was publishing a magazine called Contact, and he wanted an assistant editor. And I had no profession, no qualifications, really. And he invited me to join him at the salary of £500 a year. I was never much good at business. What I contributed was the literary side, the editorial side. And we went on with this magazine for about 12 issues. It was losing money, and we didn't have much money, much capital. And so we decided to give up the magazine and turn to general publishing. But we had no books to publish. And no author would want to publish with a brand new publisher. And so George met, in some way, a young politician who said to him, I have a book which I can't find a publisher for. It's about the coal industry. And George said, well, send it along. I'll get one of my people to look at it. One of my people being me. There wasn't anybody else. And we published it. And the point of the story, really, is the name of the author. His name was Harold Wilson.
And then, of course, much later on, you published Lolita, which was a great publicity coup. That was the 60s, wasn't it?
Yes.
But it had been officially condemned as obscene. So how did you get it into print?
Well, what we decided to do was to publish one copy, which is technical publication, by selling this one copy to a girl in the office, to one of the secretaries, you see, and then we sent this one copy and her receipt to the director of public prosecutions and the attorney general of the time, saying, now, if you want to prosecute us for obscene publication, do so on this one copy. And if we win the case, we will publish the next day. If we lose it, we will destroy the entire edition. And then we leaked this proposal to the press. It made a very good story, really. And we heard nothing except an acknowledgement. And then we decided on the eve of the expiry date, we'd give a party. We took the whole ground floor of the Ritz, which we could ill afford, and asked all our friends and journalists to come, and the author, Nabokov. And in the middle of the party, a note was handed to me from the Attorney General saying, "We've decided to take no further action. Have a good party."
And how much money did you make out of that book?
I know we sold 80,000 copies in the hardback within the next 3 weeks. And, of course, today Lolita would be regarded as so inoffensive. Mm. I mean, it's a wonderful story and a great work of literature.
Let's have some more music. Number five.
Number five is A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, which is another very soppy tune, but I associate it with the period when I came back from the war with so many other young officers, and we took up what we had missed, which was girlfriends, dancing, and the social life of a sort of debutante. And The Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square was the theme song of that particular year.
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. Perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
Glenn Miller and A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. You became, Nigel Nicholson, an MP in the 50s, but you've confessed since, if I may quote you to yourself, "I wasn't much good at politics. The most I ever did was persuade the government to allow Spanish waiters to work in Bournemouth hotels for 2 months, not 6 weeks." Which is a very good line, but I think it's a little hard on yourself, isn't it?
It's a bit hard, because I did two other things of which I'm proud, although in combination they lost me my seat. I was a strong advocate of the abolition of capital punishment. And I was opposed very publicly the Suez operation. Well, now, my constituency in Bournemouth were, of course, very right-wing, and I was rather left-wing or left of centre. And they approved of both these things, capital punishment and the Suez operation. And I was ostracised by my constituency. They thought that my behaviour was fairly disgraceful.
But you did say, did you not, that the Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, had lied?
I didn't say that then, although I knew it. We all knew in the House of Commons at that time that when he said that our purpose was to separate the combatants, as the Israelis and the Egyptians, he actually had stimulated the Israelis to attack Egypt with the intention of having the excuse to intervene and regain control of the canal. Well, now, I thought that this operation was foolish because it wouldn't work and grossly immoral. And it wouldn't work because it was immoral. You can't lie to Parliament. And I lost my seat as a result. But I can say quite honestly, it's the thing I'm most proud of having done in all my life.
Is it?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
Because I not only risked, but knew that I was destroying my political career. It wasn't much of a career, but it was something. I knew that that would happen, and yet I felt so strongly that one must speak out against a form of corruption, not money corruption, but moral corruption in Parliament.
More music.
Well, now then, the next one is...
Well, it's not music, is it?
It's not music, exactly. It's a reading. And it's a reading by one of my favourite actresses, Patricia Hodge, of a passage from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. And the passage comes towards the very end of the novel when Lady Catherine de Bourgh is trying to force Elizabeth Bennet, who is the heroine, to promise her that she would never marry Lady Catherine's nephew, Darcy. And I chose this not only because Jane Austen is my favourite author, but also because I think it shows very well how young women could stand up to bullying in round about 1795, as well as our young women do today.
I know it must be a scandalous falsehood. Can you declare that there is no foundation for it? Has he, my nephew, made you an offer of marriage? Your ladyship has declared it to be impossible. Miss Bennet, this match to which you have the presumption to aspire can never take place. Mr. Darcy is engaged to my daughter. Now, what have you to say? If he is so, you can have no reason to suppose he will make an offer to me.
Patricia Hodge, reading an extract from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, abridged by Elizabeth Bradbury. Strong stuff, as you say. Your mother was represented as rather stronger stuff in the BBC's dramatisation of Portrait of a Marriage than you represented her in the book. How did that affect you? Were you persuaded that perhaps you'd been wrong?
My objection to the way the BBC dramatised it was much too much overt sex in it. I didn't obviously really relish the idea of seeing my mother played by an actress in bed with another woman. I felt that it could have been done more subtly and gently by suggestion, by looks, by words, so no concealing the fact that they had a physical affair. But I felt this was rather too stark.
But as I say, Janet McTeer, the actress who played your mother, did play her as rather a strong, formidable character, not as the victim, which is how your book has it. Were you persuaded that perhaps you'd interpreted your mother wrongly?
No. After all, I knew my mother, and Janet, well as she did this, didn't know Vita. And Vita was not a shy person, and I think she was very much seduced by Violet Refusers. I think Violet was really almost an evil character in those days. She changed later in life.
I only ask you that because your son Adam has said that Portrait of a Marriage, your account, is a very romantic account of the relationship, and he actually, I think, used the word, he said it developed into a hagiography.
Oh, I doubt that. I think my mother behaved extraordinarily badly to my father during those 3 years. And she really spent the rest of her life making up for the cruelty she'd shown towards him during those years. But while she was at it, to desert him, whom she loved, and her children, her two boys, was really an outrageous thing to do, and I don't conceal it.
Your son Adam goes on. He says that, in fact, in writing the book, you were perhaps trying to love your mother as she never loved you.
I didn't know Adam had said that. I shall get at him about this when I see him afterwards. It's not true, that. What is true, and he suggests it, is that there was a distance between my mother and me. I never knew her very well. And I do rather regret now that I didn't make a greater effort to know her better. She was a shy person and reticent and kept her writing and, of course, her love affairs, and even her garden, very much to herself. With my father, I was very much more intimate. But now I think that she would have welcomed a more subtle approach from my side, instead of just keeping quiet about all these things. We could have discussed them.
Record number 7.
Number 7 is my old Kentucky home. Now, this, of course, is a tribute to my lifelong affection for the United States of America. About 7 years ago, I attended the Kentucky Derby at Louisville in Kentucky, the great horse race. Before the race began, the whole crowd were led by a sort of choir master into singing this wonderful song, My Old Kentucky Home, which I associate now with the whole of the United States.
Summer, the loved ones are near.
Kentucky Home, sung by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. You write a weekly column, Long Life, for The Spectator these days, and you're writing a book about George III. You wrote in one of your travel books about 10 years ago, as you mused about yourself, this is what you put, where's the reputation? It's the reputation of a grasshopper. Is that how you think of yourself? Bit of a dilettante.
Oh, dear. Yes, it is true. A bit of a dilettante. I mean, after all, what have I been? I've been a soldier, a publisher, a member of parliament, a writer, an editor of other people's letters and that sort of thing. And although each one of these has given me a great deal of pleasure at the time, I don't think I was a very good soldier, a very good publisher, even a very good politician. If I'd stuck to one of them...
To writing, do you think?
Well, perhaps to writing. I would have missed a very great deal of experience and pleasure that I've had from the other occupations.
And you've written your autobiography.
Well, I don't know how you know that, because I have, in fact, but it's locked up, and it won't be published, I don't think, ever, because it's a very, very truthful autobiography. All my weaknesses come out in it.
I understand that the opening words are, this is not for publication.
I think that's right, yes. That's what I write. And nobody's read it.
What will happen if it is published?
Well, I think it might be for my children rather the same experience as I had when I found my mother's autobiography. Of course, you know, by reading a document like my mother's, and possibly my own children, if they ever read mine, will enable them to understand things which, at the time, they didn't quite understand.
So the words, this is not for publication, are not meant entirely seriously?
Well, I think that they might think that it hasn't really been an interesting enough life. It hasn't been a dramatic life. And therefore it might be not worth publishing. But that would be for them to think, not me.
Last record.
My last record is my pop song, Puppet on a String. When Sandy Shaw won the Eurovision Song Contest with this song in the 1960s, I was about to leave for a long trip through Europe. That's not only Western Europe, but behind what was then the Iron Curtain as well, writing a book about European architecture. And I and my photographer, Ian Graham, and we had an American girl along as a secretary, in 3 months travelled through 25,000 miles of Europe. And everywhere we went, they were singing this song. And I felt it to be the sort of theme song of the new Europe. It made me very pro-Europe, I think, in a rather soppy way.
Like a puppet on a string.
Puppet on a String and Sandy Shaw. Are you going to be all right on this island, do you think?
Yes, I once actually spent a whole month alone on an island, or in three little islands, which I bought as an undergraduate for £1,500, and which my son Adam now owns. I gave them to him. And I was very lonely there, I must say. I mean, a month alone on an island is pretty grim. You find yourself talking to the sheep. And I think I would be quite competent, but I wouldn't be able to do very much in the way of cooking or growing vegetables. But I would survive.
Now, which of these records, if you could only take one of them, would you have with you?
Well, I think I could choose the Bolero. Because I think wandering around my island, this would stimulate me very much and make me feel happy.
What about a book?
I thought that it would be very pleasant on the island to take up a new study. And the study which would be very suitable would be astronomy. So what I would really like would be an up-to-date book written for the layman, but very full. A sort of guide to the universe, to the firmament.
And your luxury?
Well, the luxury, of course, goes with the book. It's got to be a telescope.
Nigel Nicholson, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.